late husband. In today's weather, it's currently about 52 degrees in New York and 60 degrees in D.C. That's all for your headline news this hour. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Please be safe and thank you for listening.
This week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
The religious Turkish government blamed fate and God for the tragedy while not mentioning the corruption it organized. Are these events and the death toll simply fate, or are they expected results of a system that has gone out of control for the pursuit of profits, money, and greed?
We'll hear from Mehmet Bayram on the results of deregulation and corruption in the deadly earthquake in Turkey.
Unless the public starts focusing on this, starts asking tough questions, we're setting ourselves up for an unaccountability moment, just like we had with the Iraq WMDs. It's just an appointment for another disaster down the line.
Journalist Sam Husseini on pandemic origins and U.S. biowarfare.
The reason he's in prison because he understands the power of working people and how the most oppressed and the poor people in the United States working under this capitalist system being used. And he was basically in prison for being a part of an organization that was exposing that and other things like police brutality. Pointing out oppression is something that's not popular to the powers that be in this country.
ILWU Local 10 past president Trent Willis discusses the upcoming barrier work stoppage, march and rally in San Francisco to demand the freedom of journalist and political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Our organization opposes all executions and we call them legal lynchings.
And a report from Texas death penalty abolition activist Gloria Ruback. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Steve Zeltzer. The major earthquake catastrophe in Turkey may turn out to be the most destructive earthquake in decades. Pacifica's Mehmet Bayram reports on the responsibility of the Erdogan government in the failure to prepare for it and the failure to enforce building standards.
An earthquake registered as 7.8 hit Turkey's southeastern provinces, causing significant damage in more than 10 large cities. Another quake hit later that registered 7.5 in magnitude, bringing down buildings, roads, bridges, and infrastructure. The death toll between Turkey and Syria on the third day is already reaching close to 12,000, while many remote areas have not been reached yet. Several geologists even predict a death toll that is in the hundreds of thousands. The disaster came at a turbulent time in Turkey. Under a 20-year rule by the Justice and Development Party, Turkey has been transforming to fully integrate with imperialism under neoliberal policies. The devastation that occurred is not due to fate, as the current government is trying to portray, nor was this destruction unavoidable. Only last year, in a small mining village, a blast in the coal mine caused 41 miners to lose their lives. In 2014, it was near this village that another mine blast killed 301 miners. What brings the two mining disasters and the recent earthquake together is how the religious Turkish government blamed fate and God for the tragedy while not mentioning the corruption it organized. Are these events and the death toll simply fate, or are they expected results of a system that has gone out of control for the pursuit of profits, money, and greed? The main supporters of Erdogan, the new and improved leader of Turkey tasked to integrate the country to imperialism, are the construction industry and the building contractors. When the country sold off its primary industries and curbed production, the only area to make money became tourism and construction. Buildings, high-rises, roads, airports, and bridges started to mushroom throughout Turkey and were mistaken for indicators of growth and development. However, together with this rose corruption, theft, bribery, gang rule, and the mafia run by the government. The contractors knew they had to make a quick buck, and to do that, all safety regulations and requirements were ignored. The government looked away as the government-friendly industry built building after building without observance of regulations or safety. This was the method, the practice, the new way of profiteering. And every few years, the government would pass a construction forgiveness law that allowed this to continue. Even the government buildings that were supposed to be the safest place provided in the last quake to crumble and collapse with the first shake. The state hospitals, the police headquarters, and schools were the first to go, although they were all built after the earthquake regulations were put in effect. Engineers and scientists warned that an earthquake disaster was waiting at the door. The foremost geologist, a professor, even gave the magnitude and the location of the coming earthquake years earlier. Unfortunately, he was proven correct in both accounts. Yet the government ignored not only him, but the entire Geological Engineering Association and other experts. Profits and making a quick buck were more important than safety. Religious people appointed by the Muslim government of Erdogan occupied offices and looked down upon science. The construction industry keeps Erdogan in power, and he keeps them happy by allowing them to do whatever they want. The largest construction companies are called the Gang of Five. They get nearly all the government building projects. These corporations are mainly in the construction business. Turkish government contracts out unnecessary building projects to these corporations, which in turn pay back bribes with the exorbitant earnings from these sweetheart deals. As a boondoggle for the friendly building corporations, the Turkish government built an airport near a very small city, guaranteeing over 1 million passengers. According to the agreement, if there are fewer than 1 million passengers, the government pays for these missing flyers to the airport managing corporation. Both the contractors and the managing corporation hit the jackpot with this deal. There have been months when not a single plane flew or took off from this airport. However, the government paid all the expenses of air conditioning, security, electrical bills, personnel, and cleaning, as well as the cost of those missing 1 million passengers. A contractor association claims Turkey has 500,000, that is 500,000 contractors, while entire Europe has only 37,000. Germany, a much larger and more prosperous country than Turkey, has only 2,700 contractors. It does not require any special skills or education to be a contractor in Turkey, and the result of their work proved deadly in the last earthquake. Brand new buildings being sold as luxury apartments, missing the necessary columns to hold the structure, lacking sufficient iron, and having the low-quality cement crumbled with the people still in them. While the corrupt contractor industry enjoyed a free hand, other structural organizations of the country were open to the feeding frenzy of the so-called free market, neoliberal capitalist system. This had devastating effects, as witnessed in the last earthquake disaster. The Red Crescent, similar to the Red Cross organization, was turned into a trading post business, modeled after the thought that organizations perform better if they are run like businesses. Behind the move was privatizing the outfit and looting its assets, and bankrupting the state treasury for the benefit of the friends and families of the government. While millions of dollars of tax monies were poured into the organization, after the earthquake several days, not a single Red Crescent tent or rescue center was to be seen. However, the organization has a CEO, 11 sub-corporations, and 11 general managers. It has turned into a holding corporation and organized to do business instead of helping people in need. The Red Crescent acts like a branch of the religious ruling party AKP and is disinterested in organizing or preparing for disasters or relief efforts. After the 1999 earthquake, the government imposed a tax for earthquake preparations. With some estimates, billions of dollars were collected for earthquake preparedness. However, this money has completely evaporated. When questioned, the minister in charge admitted the money was gone and dismissively stated that it was used for farmer education and road building. That is, projects given to the friendly corporations in the Gang of Five. Later documents revealed that soccer clubs and other entertainment were also paid with this money. Red Crescent diverted the funds to give unnecessary contracts to a religious organization close to the government. It rented a mansion with spectacular views and a swimming pool for $12,000 a month. Is it any wonder this organization was missing in action when hundreds of thousands of people lay dead under the rubble of houses built by corrupt contractors? When international organizations sent funds to the Red Crescent, they chose to buy luxury SUVs with this money, claiming they were needed for off-road emergency rescues. However, they were not seen in the rescue efforts, even in the city centers with wide roads when the earthquake hit. However, this should not surprise us when we live in a capitalist get-rich-quick system. The Turkish government is desperate, but not for rushing aid to the survivors spending night hungry, thirsty, and without shelter under the freezing temperatures. Erdogan is worried about the media, damage control, and the upcoming elections on May 14th. When not a single day passed without his presence on national TVs in the past, curiously, the president disappeared for 2.5 days after the earthquake. And in his first speech after he reappeared, he threatened those who criticized the lack of government in the disaster area. He said the government was keeping a secret book on those who were spreading false information, and when the day came, the books would be open and those would be dealt with. Two journalists are being investigated by the general attorney for questioning why the government was absent. They will probably be prosecuted for inciting riots and hate speech, a catch-all charge to intimidate the opposition. A social scientist was detained for the very same reason. The government took down Twitter to prevent people from complaining about receiving no help. The government started confiscating the aid people gathered and transported to the disaster region. The Communist Party of Turkey has opened help centers. Communist doctors have gone to the region to help with the relief effort. However, the police tried pushing them out and closing their help centers. Any foreign aid coming in must declare which municipality it is sent to. This allows the government to confiscate any necessities and divert them to the friendly areas and starving the opposition neighborhoods. Obviously, the foreign senders will have no idea about local municipalities, and the help will be confiscated and used for Erdogan's propaganda. Help and trucks sent by opposition organizations are being confiscated, banners taken down, and government banners are hung on the same trucks to give the impression that the help is coming from the Erdogan government. The earthquake showed the total collapse of a regime in Turkey. A regime that squandered and sold off its resources for privatization and profit-making. The regime had lifted regulations so the friendly contractors could benefit, resulting in the tragedy we see on TV. A regime that benefited only a very few at the top, while people were left vulnerable to the coming earthquake, mining disasters, or the COVID pandemic is criminal. The blood of all the people crushed under the debris is not due to God or fate, but is dripping from the hands of the Erdogan government. Reporting for Pacifica, this is Mehmet Bayram.
That was Robert Glasper, So Beautiful. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Steve Zeltzer. The 2014 deadly Ebola virus outbreak in West Africa that killed over 11,000 people and was an economic and social calamity may have originated in a U.S.-funded biological laboratory, newly published research suggests. If that is indeed the case, what about other outbreaks? Producer Polina Vasilyev has more.
This is Polina Vasilyev with COVID Race and Democracy, and we are discussing COVID-19 origins today. This issue has been twisted by political factions from the start. Some have wrongly dismissed lab origins, and some have weaponized it against China. Our guest today says that both factions are wrong, and that instead, it's about dangerous lab work, biowarfare by another name, and it poses an existential threat to humanity. Independent journalist Sam Husseini has been tracking the issue of pandemic origins since February of 2020. In the course of that work, he has investigated the 2014 Ebola virus outbreak in West Africa and found a notable series of connections between that event and COVID-19. Sam Husseini joins us now. Welcome.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
First, before we talk about Ebola in West Africa and the connection to U.S. biolabs in the region then and the link to COVID now, I have to say that you were one of the few on the left who took the COVID lab origin hypothesis seriously from the start. Now we're hearing about it from the Republicans in Congress and from the Lancet's COVID-19 Commission Chair, Jeffrey Sachs, alike. Briefly, how do you see this line of inquiry today?
I view it as dangerous lab work that is connected to a militarized science. The enemy here isn't science. The enemy here is the political economy of science. And like a lot of things in our society, the life sciences have been taken over by a militarized aspect of our society. So I questioned the CDC in February of 2020. They gave me a very disingenuous answer, and that's why I've been focusing on this. I've been relying on my reporting on various sources, including Francis Boyle, who wrote the U.S. implementing legislation for the Bioweapons Convention, and Dr. Meryl Nass, who basically proved the first known use of biowarfare against Black Rhodesian farmers in the 1970s. There were two pillars of propaganda to dismiss the possibility of lab origins in early 2020. One was a Lancet letter organized by Peter Daszak and his circles. Peter Daszak heads EcoHealth Alliance, which sounds like a nice earthy crunchy thing, but it's not. They get some money from the NIH, and that was highly publicized, but they get far more money from the Pentagon and even more money from USAID, which is kind of viewed as a sort of soft power CIA. It's under the State Department. And it has connections to big tech. The other pillar of propaganda was an article that appeared in Nature Medicine that purported to, and the first one, The Lancet, said, it pretended to be a statement of solidarity to frontline workers, but it was actually a dismissal of lab origins as a quote unquote conspiracy theory. The Nature Medicine article purported to show that COVID wasn't a laboratory construct. One of the things that's fascinating about that is that the two main authors in scientific journals, the most notable authors are the first and the last. And Christian Anderson at Scripps Research was one, and Robert Gary was at Tulane University was the other. What's particularly interesting about them is that they are the two heads, president and vice president, of the Viral Hemorrhagic Fever Consortium, which is a lab in West Africa, U.S. run by those two groups, as well as Harvard University, and it has other partners as well. And they were accused in 2014 by Africans of having sparked the Ebola outbreak that killed 11,000 people, turned the region upside down. It was the leading crisis in 2014. So I started digging, in part because of the disingenuous answer that I got from the CDC, and in part because the scientists there was a large degree of silence among independent scientists in 2020. I think there's a great deal of intimidation, funding and otherwise. in the field, but I got a couple of scientists to say, this is a disingenuous article. This Nature Medicine article does not add up. It is not a legitimate scientific argument that they're making here. They're just stating their opinion fundamentally. Richard Ebright and others at Rutgers University. So I started digging, and I joined up with Jonathan Latham, who's a virologist at Independent Science News, where I've gotten several pieces published. And I found the work of Cherno Ba, who's an independent journalist from Sierra Leone, as well as another African author, Constantine Nana. They both wrote books, and they didn't say that they knew that the 2014 outbreak had lab origins, but they indicated that the dominant narrative didn't add up and that this should be examined. So Jonathan and I took their work, distilled it, and tried to build on it, examining it. The dominant narrative has it that the Ebola outbreak began by a toddler playing with bats in a village. They claimed that the toddler was 2 years old. He was actually 18 months, probably too young to be playing with bats. They didn't find any Ebola in the village. The father, who's the caretaker, the mother and child died. The father didn't get Ebola, even though he was the caretaker. The healthcare workers didn't get Ebola, even though they were taking care of them. They don't think, neither the father nor the healthcare workers think that those cases were Ebola. They think that they were malaria. Okay. In past Ebola outbreaks, there was a die-off of a mammalian species. That is, when there was a zoonotic jump, local mammals, chimpanzees, and others would die off. That didn't happen in this case, as the scientists themselves, these scientific journals, these improper scientific journals, they'll have a ultra-confident statement at the very beginning, and the media will pick up on that. But then if you actually read it, you'll realize that the evidence that they cite doesn't actually back up their ultra-confident conclusion. And they didn't find any Ebola in the village. They pointed to a burnt out tree where they alleged the bats were that had the Ebola, but there was a fire and therefore the bats weren't there anymore. And additionally, and this was one of the striking parallels with COVID, it was more than 1,000 miles away from prior outbreaks of Ebola. So, you had these theories about these amazing flying bats that'll fly, more than 1,000 miles without any trace. And then suddenly you have this massive outbreak.
Yeah, it reminds us very much eerily of what the narrative was about China in COVID.
Here, the framing was the U.S. labs are in Kenema, Sierra Leone.
Right.
They pinned it on a village just across the border in Guinea. So they got it to the next country over, just barely. And this seems to be part of a pattern of effectively what we call framing Guinea. And there were other aspects to this as well. For example, Metabiota, who people might be familiar with because of their tie-ins to Ukraine and various forms of corruption there, they were an affiliate of the Viral Hemorrhagic Fever Consortium. And they seem to have been scandalously undercounting cases in Sierra Leone. When Doctors Without Borders finally got there to help assist in their final report, they excoriated Medibiota and talked about a hidden outbreak in Sierra Leone. This was, to the extent that it was reported on, depicted as bungling. But we are left to wonder if it wasn't bungling, if it was actually part of a concerted effort to downplay the origins of the outbreak in Sierra Leone in order to get it away from the lab and to the next country over. Another aspect of this is Eric Lander, who was the founding director of the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard, which was also a partner of the Viral Hemorrhagic Fever Consortium. And he wrote an article along with other people with the Viral Hemorrhagic Fever Consortium, including Robert Gary, purporting to show that the phylogenetic analysis shows that the outbreak had started in Guinea. Jonathan Latham, my co-author, examined that and found that the way that they rooted the phylogenetic analysis was inappropriate. And we hypothesized that this also was another form of attempting to frame Guinea. People might recall that Eric Lander Joe Biden's science advisor until he stepped down at a time when he was apparently abusing staff about a year ago. So there are, you know, several strands. An additional strand, people might have heard that there was a pause in so-called gain-of-function research in 2014. Gain-of-function is a euphemism. It sounds like a good thing. It's not. It's saying that what's gaining function in this context is the pathogen.
Yeah.
That is, they're making the pathogen more deadly or more easily transmissible. Some experiments relating to the avian flu in 2011, 2012 caused a furor in certain circles, but they continued, and indeed they've been accelerated. So
you're talking about making the avian flu more contagious.
Correct.
And it's a deadly pathogen.
Correct. Avian flu is highly deadly, but not easily transmissible. They effectively weaponized it. NIH funded scientists in the Netherlands and at the University of Wisconsin effectively weaponized it. I've seen estimates that if this were to become public, we would have somewhere between 1 billion with a B and half the Earth's population would die. This is an existential threat that we are talking about here. So on October 17th, 2014, Ron Klain was named Ebola czar for the Obama administration. That very same day is when the Obama administration put in place the pause for funding for gain-of-function lab work. People might have heard that there was this pause and that it was lifted under the Trump administration at the urging of Anthony Fauci in 2017. But it's notable, we hypothesize, that it happened that day. And no one, to my knowledge, has much made of that potential connection. That is, did the Obama administration suspect that the Ebola outbreak came from a lab? There was also at this time a federal cutoff of funding to Tulane University, again, indicating that some people in the government maybe didn't want to create a huge stink about it, but wanted to distance themselves from what's going on here. So we now are in this perverse situation, and we've been in this perverse situation before. People might remember the anthrax attacks, which came out of a U.S. lab. They targeted senators who were standing in the way of the Patriot Act. They got Bush, Cheney got the Patriot Act through, got their Afghan invasion. There was a state of complete fear in the United States. People were afraid to open their mail at the time. You know, snail mail was actually important in 2001. And then they ramped up this spending on so-called biodefense / biowarfare. In 2005, 700 scientists signed a petition objecting to this. Anthony Fauci and company basically told him to put up or shut up. And now we're seeing the same sort of pattern, where now, to the extent that you're having hearings in Congress and the Democrats stalled hearings, and now the Republicans are finally having them, but they're extremely deformed in a number of ways. And one of the ways that they're deformed is that they are saying, oh, gosh, if it did come out of a lab, then we need to spend more on building better labs. So they're, in effect, they're depicting this as increased capacity. But all this is going to lead to is more of this kind of dangerous work in more places around the world, which, you know, it's kind of the equivalent of putting out fire with gasoline. It's kind of the equivalent of saying, oh, gosh, there's resentment against us in the Middle East. We need to intervene more.
Yeah.
You're in effect doing the thing as a solution, portraying it as a solution when it's actually the problem. And as you alluded to earlier, the parallels are really striking in terms of the depictions of, you know, these primitive people eating bats and these Chinese wet markets, these basically racist tropes that are wielded out. And sometimes people don't perceive that they're racist tropes, including liberals, that somehow it's racist to think that it could have come out of a Chinese lab rather than out of Chinese cuisine or culture. Right. I should add that I'm trying to be very thorough in my reporting, whether it's Independent Science News or on my Substack at Husseini.substack.com, if I can plug that. It's because it's been very hard to do independent reporting on this, because on the one hand, you have so many liberals and establishment media and even progressives or have been in complete denial about the dangers of bio lab work, even though, you know, they're, you know, if they're anti-militaristic in other venues, they somehow don't perceive the threat in the life sciences. And on the other side, you have Republicans, and not just Republicans, you have some Democrats as well, using this to bash China.
Right.
So I'm very glad to have an independent perch, but that means that, you know, I signed up for Substack right away, and I didn't use it right away because I was trying to get stuff into different outlets where I had success in the past. But in this issue, there was no success to be had. So there's a real blind spot across the political spectrum. So I've attempted to get information out.
Yeah, and thank you for doing that. A couple of things that you mentioned, Eco Health Alliance, Peter Daszak, his name appears everywhere. You mentioned Eco Health Alliance has funding from the Pentagon and USAID.
Correct. Yeah. If you want just a one-line description, the Pentagon contractor would be, you know, much more appropriate than some of the other stuff that I've heard. Peter Daszak got away with murder. He funded the lab in Wuhan. He drafted the Lancet letter saying that it's a conspiracy theory to think that it came out of the lab in Wuhan. He made that the dominant media narrative and deceived the global public. He then got on the WHO commission to find out where the pandemic started from. Anybody who objected, he claimed that he had no conflicts of interest. He then got Jeffrey Sachs to name him onto the Lancet committee that they were forming. I immediately emailed Jeffrey Sachs, who I sort of had tangential dealings with, and he never responded. And I laid out all of the egregious conflicts. I had a massive piece on Peter Daszak published in late 2020. And I think that had some effect in turning the tide. You had some BBC reporters pick up on that and start asking Daszak some tough questions. Finally, in I think late or midsummer of 2021, you know, finally Jeffrey Sachs cut him off and other people cut him off. And The Lancet finally published a sort of backpedaling, although it's not nearly enough. And it had its own levels of deceit in it, but some level of isolation from of his work. But he's still getting funded. He's still demanding more money. And he's getting more money to do dangerous lab work. They just had a hearing on Capitol Hill, the Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Oversight, and I wrote that up. And there was, you know, one or two Republican congressmen said, you know, a little bit critical of him, but it was nothing major. None of the witnesses that they had seriously scrutinized him or other aspects of this. This is a major scandal. This person is still being, and the Republicans are fixating on China, saying, oh, China's not being straightforward, da, 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 da. That may well be true, but they have no control over China. What they do have control over is they could have subpoena power over EcoHealth Alliance. They could have subpoena power over the NIH. They could have subpoena power over all of the U.S. agencies and academic institutions involved in this. University of California at Davis was a major funding source for all of this. They should be subpoenaing all of that information. They have that power, and they're not doing it. So, you know, unless the public starts focusing on this, starts asking tough questions, and unless there's more and more serious reporting, we're setting ourselves up for an unaccountability moment, just like we had with the Iraq WMDs. And then you know, it's just an appointment for another disaster down the line. People need to be held accountable, and the full force of the law and scrutiny and transparency has to be applied here.
That was independent journalist Sam Husseini speaking to Pacifica's Polina Vasilyev. To read Sam Husseini's work, visit husseini.substack.com.
We will not bow down. I just can't tolerate racism. I just
tolerate no injustice.
I just can't tolerate
exploitation. I'm gonna stay. I'm gonna stay.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock, I'm Gonna Stand. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Steve Zeltzer. On Thursday, February 16th, all San Francisco Bay Area ports will be shut down in support of the freedom of CWA NABIT journalist and political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. He has a chance at a new trial and his release after 40 years in prison. The ILWU Local 2 longshore workers have decided to have a shutdown of all ports in the Bay Area to demand his freedom, and their rally will be joined by the teachers from the Oakland Education Association and the United Educators of San Francisco. I interviewed past ILWU Local 10 president, Trent Willis, who is also on the organizing committee of the planned rally for the freedom of Mumia Abu-Jamal. So, Trent, why don't you talk about this action by the ILWU that's going to be happening on the 16th, and why it's important not only for longshore workers, why you took it, but why it's important for all working people.
Well, the reason it's important for all working people is because the person that we're protesting to be freed is a vanguard, is standing in the vanguard for working people. The reason he's in prison because he understands the power of working people and how the most oppressed and the poor people in the United States working in under this capitalist system, you know, being used. And he was basically in prison for being a part of an organization that was exposing that and other things like police brutality, pointing out oppression is something that's not popular to the powers that be in this country.
And the murder of Tyre Nichols, how is this connected to what's happening with Mumia?
It's an ongoing thing, especially for Black people to see these kinds of things happen over and over again. It's related to Mumia because Mumia is in jail right now, falsely accused of killing a police officer. The thing that some people think is ironic is that when we fast forward to the most recent case here, that there were Black police officers who committed this crime. And, you know, I'm not a spokesman for Black people, but, you know, Black people have been saying all along that it doesn't make any difference what nationality the police is, you know, what nationality the police officer is. We have to change the system as a whole. Okay, the system is what is killing Black people, unarmed Black people in the street. Doesn't really matter who has the uniform on. And I think that the murder, this last police murder, exposes, you know, what organizations like Black Lives Matter, organizations that oppose police brutality, organizations that oppose the jailing of political prisoners, people who stand up against an evil system that's committing all of these atrocities. You know, so Brother Mumia is a symbol of opposition to those atrocities, and that's why he's been in prison so long. That's why he's been treated like he has in prison for so long. The only reason, and this is my personal opinion, I believe the only reason he's alive today is because of the massive movement to free him. But even though there's that massive movement to free him and this attention on his case, he's still being mistreated in jail, and he's being what I consider killed slowly. And this is why it's such an emergency to get him out of prison, where he can receive proper medical care, he can eat healthier foods, and he can be treated for ailments that he has properly so that he can live, you know, a normal life. He's an innocent man anyway, so he should be able to live like an innocent man.
And the ILWU has a history of taking political action, work action. You shut down the port for Oscar Grant. You've shut down the West Coast for the freedom of Mumia Abu-Jamal. What do you have to say to other unions? Because it seems like ILWU is an exception, not the rule, to workers in this country taking political action against murder, against systemic racism. It seems like a lot of workers are being affected, and the union should be taking action as well as the ILWU.
Well, you know, I talked about the capitalist system earlier when we first started talking, and one part of that system is to, one of the evil parts of that system is to distract workers and to make sure that they don't understand that what moves the country, and that includes politics, is labor. The key to everything is labor. Whenever revolutions are stomped out, or when organizations are attacked from within by the government and dismantled, it's all because there's a fear of a withholding of labor. They are afraid that these revolutionary leaders and people who are exposing governmental misbehaviors and things like that are going to get to the people, and then the people will refuse to work, because that's the basis of prosperity in this country, is how the billionaires are getting rich. They're getting rich off of the labor of people. And people like Momia expose them for that and teach people that we should fight for higher wages. We should fight for political change through our labor organizations, which makes us stronger. So these are the things that the powers that be that want to keep oppression alive. They don't want working people to know this.
And this action that you're going to be having on July the 16th, you're going to be marching from Union Hall to Harry Bridges Plaza near the Ferry Building in San Francisco, have a rally at 1. It's also being joined by NUMSA, the South African Trade Union, RETUSA in Durban and Pretoria, and also Dorochiba in Tokyo. Is this an international movement that is happening on the 16th?
Well, the fight to free Momia has always been an international movement. Unfortunately, this is not my first experience with being involved in organizing an event to, you know, keep awareness on what's happening to Brother Momia. The reason I'm proud to be a member of a union like the ILWU is because the ILWU is real good at what I consider being on the right side of history. We've had a long relationship with NUMSA and the other South African unions, where we've connected on many different causes. I'd be here for hours if I went through the list of causes that the ILWU has been involved in to advocate for the freedom of people in general. So, you know, this is, I don't mean to talk about it like it's just another thing that we're doing, because it's that important that we need to shine awareness on this situation and others like it constantly to educate working people in America. But I do have to say, this is something that we do, and we've been doing for many years. One of my first experiences in being involved in a demonstration was when I first started as a longshore worker, and it was a rally to free Momia. And I've been a longshore worker for 26 years now. So that to me is sad that he's been imprisoned the whole time that I've been a member of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. And I'd like to see him released, you know, by the time I retire. I'm probably going to retire in 6 years, and that'll mean he'll have been in prison the whole time I've been in the workforce and a member of this strong union. You know, so that to me is a sad thing, but I'm also glad to be a part of an organization that joins with other organizations to free political prisoners like Momia.
That was San Francisco ILWU Local 10 past president Trent Willis discussing the upcoming Bay Area work stoppage, march, and rally in San Francisco to demand the freedom of CWA NABIT journalist and political prisoner Momia Abu-Jamal.
That was Chris Stapleton, Death Row. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Steve Zeltzer. Texas death penalty abolition movement and others recently protested the executions of Wesley Ruiz on February 1st and John Ballantyne on February 8th, 2023, outside of the state prison in Huntsville, Texas. Additionally, 34-year-old Terrence Andrus died by suicide due to the mental toll of solitary confinement on death row in Texas. Andrus was diagnosed with affective psychosis, a mood disorder causing hallucinations in elementary school. Here's a report from Texas death penalty abolition activist Gloria Ruback.
This is Gloria Ruback in Houston, Texas, with the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement. The abolition movement has been involved in protesting executions since the first one in the so-called modern era, which was 1982 here in Texas. One of the things that recently happened on death row in Texas was an African-American man by the name of Terrence Andrus hanged himself in his cell at the age of 34. This came a little more than 6 months after the Supreme Court had denied reviewing his case for the second time. And it's a very sad situation because they found him hanging, and when they found him, he was dead. But from the age of 16 on, he was in an overcrowded juvenile detention center, given huge doses of psychotropic drugs, and placed in solitary. And this is a child, right? Just days after Andrus' suicide, Texas death row prisoners filed a lawsuit on January 26th against the state of Texas because of solitary, because of the conditions that they have to live under, which is literally causing men not only to commit suicide or to mutilate themselves, but to lose their minds. And I've had several friends that I can't communicate with anymore because they are no longer there mentally. And I do want to say this prolonged solitary and indefinite solitary, which is what the men on Texas death row are under, is a violation of the United Nations standard minimum rules for the treatment of prisoners. And those rules are more commonly known as the Nelson Mandela rules. We had been trying to get lawyers to file a suit about solitary, and none of the lawyers in Texas from the ACLU on were interested. This lawsuit now is being taken up by a law firm based in London, and thank heavens for them. Texas has executed 3 people this year. I think there's 7 more already scheduled for this year, and probably there will be others. This past Wednesday, there was an execution. And then the previous Wednesday, there was an execution. This past Wednesday, which was February 9th, an African-American man named John Ballantyne was put to death. There was a dozen or more of us outside of the death house in Huntsville. And it was really sad for me because I saw John in the visiting room the Saturday before he was to be executed. And there was a possibility that he was going to get a 90-day reprieve. And his attorney was there, and the attorney said, you know, he really wanted those 90 days. But I watched him visiting his daughter and granddaughter, and it broke my heart because his children were smiling, they were laughing. He was obviously very happy to be visiting them. And then 5 days later, he's dead. What didn't come out until he was already executed was that the racism that took place in his trial, which was really horrific, from the jury foreman using the N-word. And anyway, the Wednesday before that, a Chicano man by the name of Wesley Lynn Ruiz was put to death. That was a sad day to be in Huntsville because his dad was going to witness the execution, and about 15 or 20 members of his family were standing outside with us, including his two sons. And I spoke to his two boys. They must have been in their 20s. One of them was on leave from the military, and it was almost like they were in the Twilight Zone because it's so hard to comprehend how somebody healthy can be put to death. Texas has executed 581 people since the Supreme Court reinstated the death penalty in the mid-1970s. 581 out of about 1,500. So you can see that Texas is over one third of the United States' executions. The last execution, I believe, was Texas Governor Greg Abbott's 63rd execution. The next six states combined do not even total 500. So Texas is really an outlier when it comes to legal lynchings. People don't realize this, but executions not only do not deter crime, but actually are harder on the victims' families because people on death row get quite a number of appeals, which means the victims' families have to relive the horror of losing a loved one over and over and over again. So it's no deterrent and it's no closure for families of the victims. Last year, 2022, was known as the year of botched executions. Executions where they couldn't find a vein, they finally had to call off some of them, and so on. So that is why our organization opposes all executions, and we call them legal lynchings. Next month in March, there will be three executions. On March 7th, 2023, is Gary Green. March 9th, 2023, is Arthur Brown, my friend. And March 29th is Anibal Canales. I have reported on the recent suicide of Terrence Andrews, the last two executions that were held in February of 2023 in Huntsville, and the upcoming executions. I hope to be able to report soon on the number of innocent people that have died, have been killed, executed by the state, and the number of innocent people is up to 190-something in the United States of people that have been exonerated off death row. So if there's been that many exonerations, there's probably several times that number of people that are now 6 feet under. So this is Gloria Ruback with the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement reporting from Houston, Texas for COVID, Race, and Democracy.
And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister station affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by Akua Holt, Alina Vasilyev, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button and follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Steve Zeltzer. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Here are some headlines for this hour. 5 years ago today, on February 14, 2018, 17 students and faculty members at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, were killed as a result of a mass shooting. To mark this deadly anniversary, President Joe Biden has announced $231 million in Justice Department funding to, quote, reduce gun violence and save lives. In a statement released today, the president said, and I quote, "While today's announcement will make communities safer, we have more work to do. I once again call on Congress to enact common sense gun law reforms, including requiring background checks on all gun sales, banning assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, and eliminating immunity for gun manufacturers who knowingly put weapons of war on our streets, end quote. He added, "We owe it to all those we've lost and to all those left behind to grieve, to continue to act," end quote. Earlier today, the president and first lady also released a statement saying that they're praying for the victims and families of yesterday's mass shooting at Michigan State University. The Michigan State University massacre is the 67th mass shooting of this year, according to the Gun Violence Archive, and we're only 45 days into the year. Three students were killed and five others were injured before the gunman took his own life. Officials have said that the shooter, a 43-year-old male who was previously arrested on a weapons violation in 2019, was not affiliated with Michigan State University, so his motive for the massacre remains unclear. However, police have confirmed that the shooter had a note in his pocket saying that he was going to, quote, finish off Lansing. Lansing is the area in Michigan where the university is located. The gunman's note also detailed threats against two schools in New Jersey, where he grew up. According to the shooter's family members, he had become isolated socially and turned, quote, evil angry after the death of his mother in 2020, whom he often clashed with while she was alive. He also refused attempts from his father, whom he lived with, to get him mental health assistance. To your local news, in New York City, investigators are still trying to determine the motive behind yesterday's deadly U-Haul rampage, where the driver of a rented U-Haul truck plowed into several people on streets, bike lanes, and sidewalks of two Brooklyn neighborhoods, killing one person and injuring eight others. Although the motive remains unclear, NYPD Commissioner Keyshawn Sewell stated that there's no evidence currently suggesting that the driver, a 62-year-old male now in police custody, had any affiliation with terrorist groups. However, according to the driver's family, he has a history of mental illness and multiple acts of violence, including stabbing his own brother, for which he was jailed. At the time of the driver's arrest yesterday, he reportedly told officers he wanted to die and claimed that he, quote, only ran over bad people, not good people, end quote. The official added that the driver had not been taking medication that he should have been taking. The driver faces potential attempted murder charges. In the D.C. area, Ethel Kennedy, the 94-year-old widow of late Senator Robert F. Kennedy, now has a new namesake in Washington, D.C., in the form of a new building that will provide housing for the city's residents who recently experienced homelessness. This new building, named the Ethel, is located in Southeast D.C.'s East Hill neighborhood, which is being revitalized. According to Mayor Muriel Bowser, the Ethel will provide fitness facilities, cooking classes, a clothing closet, hair salon, and on-site caseworkers who will connect residents with health care and professional development services. In a letter read by Mrs. Kennedy's daughter, former Maryland Lieutenant Governor Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, Ethel Kennedy said, and I quote, "I'm so honored that you would name a building dedicated to improving the lives of homeless women and men after me," end quote. She also expressed happiness